strategies that work. And I'm Robert Macron. I'm the State Director of the New York State Division of Probation and Correctional Alternatives. This series has been hosted by the, sponsored by the New York State Division of Criminal Justice Services and the New York State Office of Children and Family Services, together with the New York State Division of Probation and Correctional Alternatives. And it's been a very exciting series, and I'm pleased to be able to moderate today's session with you. Welcome to the fourth installment on cost-effective juvenile justice reform. I'm pleased to be here today as your moderator at this session, as this session will focus on innovative community-based strategies that have been effectively implemented by law enforcement, probation, and prosecutors. The initiatives highlighted today will focus on truly front-end policies, programs, and interventions that effectively divert nonviolent youth from the costly and largely ineffective juvenile placement system. We are fortunate today to have three leaders in local juvenile justice policy here with us to share the innovative and effective community-based strategies that they've implemented in places with significant juvenile crime issues, Miami, Washington, D.C., and our own New York City. We will begin with an interview conducted by David Gustina of Northeast Public Radio to be aired on NPR at a later date. He will have the opportunity to speak with Wansley Walters, the director of the Miami-Dade Juvenile Services Department. After the interview is complete, we'll take a short break and then have the opportunity to hear some summary remarks from Ms. Walters, followed by presentations from Terry Odom, who's the director of Court Social Services in D.C., Washington, D.C., about effective community-based probation strategies being employed there, and then from Larry Bushing, Chief of the Family Court Division of the New York City Department of Law, about prosecutorial tools to use community-based strategies while preserving public safety. I'm pleased to first introduce to you Wansley Walters, Director of the Miami-Dade Juvenile Services Department. Ms. Walters has over 25 years of experience in child advocacy and has led a transformation of the juvenile justice system in Miami-Dade County, Florida. Overseeing a national demonstration project rooted in one centralized juvenile assessment center that serves as a centralized processing, referral, and evaluation center for all juveniles arrested in Miami-Dade County, the project allows representatives from law enforcement and social services to work together under one roof to provide a complete range of services and programs at the initial stages of the juvenile's involvement with the juvenile justice system. This has proven to be an efficient model of processing that has allowed the state of Florida and local communities to achieve system and fiscal efficiencies. The delivery mechanism used to provide JSD/JAC services and programs is achieved through four major components: the intake and screening component, the diversion services continuum, the prevention continuum, and the clinical unit. Welcome to Albany, Ms. Walters. We're looking forward to learning from the systems change that you have overseen. And thank you, Mr. Gustina, for joining us at our symposium series. Welcome, everyone.
Well, this is a lively crowd. Welcome. Yeah, you can clap. It's okay. We're having a good discussion today. As he said, my name is David Gustina. Normally in this spot today would have been Dr. Alan Shartok. Unfortunately, he sends his apologies. He had to have some minor surgery, so he's been out this week. He basically turned to me and said, "You're doing it." And then when I began to read about what I was doing, boy, was I excited, because I think we're going to have a wonderful program today. Wansley Walters, if you've been reading about what she's been doing down in Miami with, of course, not just you, but your community, it's quite an incredible example and a benchmark, I think, for not only around the country, but she's been traveling around the world, telling me just now she was just in Thailand back in May, and they're coming over to Miami when she gets back from here to study what they've been doing. So we're going to run a radio program here, and when I introduce the program, I hope you will share your enthusiasm and clap wildly, and then we will get right into it. It's going to go about, just about an hour, and my timekeeper over here will dutifully tell me when we're getting close to the end. I just hope you enjoy it, and we'll try to get everything in if we can. Wansley, are you ready?
I'm ready.
Gentlemen who are recording, are you ready? I got the nod. Here we go. Hello and welcome to the Huxley Theater at the New York State Museum for the fourth symposium in our five-part series, Enhancing Community Safety Through Cost-Effective Juvenile Justice Reform. A wonderful crowd here with us today. Thank you for joining us. I'm David Gustina for WAMC Northeast Public Radio, and I'm honored to be filling in for Dr. Alan Chartok for this Division of Criminal Justice Services Symposium Series on Juvenile Justice. This series is supported with a generous grant from the Public Welfare Foundation as being co-sponsored by the Division of Criminal Justice Services, the Office of Children and Family Services, the Division of Probation and Correctional Alternatives, Assemblyman William Scarborough, and Senator Velmanette Montgomery. A reminder that if you haven't heard our other programs in the series or wish to hear one again, you can always visit our website at www.wamc.org. Just click on the pull-down menu for WAMC programs and click on Speaker's Corner. Now for today's program. As we return to the series on juvenile justice today, we're reminded of past programs where we've explored such issues as when children should be arrested and whether they should be jailed while awaiting trial, fairness and racial equity in juvenile justice system, what can be done at the community level to address juvenile crime, and how large justice systems can be changed. All of this is an effort to help New Yorkers and New York State better understand its juvenile justice system and hopefully improve it. To that end, I am pleased today to have the opportunity to talk with Wansley Walters, director of the Miami-Dade County Juvenile Justice Services Department, whose mission is to serve arrested juveniles, those at risk of being arrested, and the families of these youth. Formerly known as the Juvenile Assessment Center, or JAC, it is the largest juvenile arrest processing center in the U.S., serving over 130,000 juvenile arrests in Miami-Dade County alone since opening in 1997. In the mid-90s, the juvenile justice system in Miami-Dade County was so dysfunctional that organized crime was recruiting kids and employing them as laborers in their criminal enterprises. By 1995, annual arrest rates of juveniles hit 20,000 in a community of about 2 million, and it was roundly believed the worst was yet to come. And as you can imagine, in a state that relies so heavily on tourism, Florida, an increase in high-profile and violent juvenile offenses was more than a little troublesome. The system was, in short, a disaster. Authorities didn't seem to know anything more about juvenile crime than how many juveniles were arrested. And even that was hard to figure out. What with over 30 law enforcement agencies individually processing arrested juveniles? Officials in Florida knew they had to do something, and that initial something was to get a handle on what was actually going on. And as is often the case, defining the nature and scope of a problem is the first step towards solving it. Well, whatever they did, it worked. Between 1998 and 2007, the recidivism rate for juveniles dropped 78%. Juvenile arrests were down 41%, and the daily population of the juvenile detention centers dropped by nearly 67%. That's two-thirds. Today, the Miami-Dade County Juvenile Services Department is recognized as a national juvenile justice model. The agency has partnered with the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy, and Ms. Walters developed and heads a national demonstration project with the U.S. Department of Justice and national researchers in the field of juvenile justice. Ms. Walters is a frequent presenter on juvenile justice in both national and international conferences, and we welcome you, Ms. Walters, to the program.
Thank you very much, David.
Well, the obvious question is, what the heck did you do that worked down there in Miami-Dade? But we're not going to start with the obvious question, because I want to get a little more personal first.
Okay.
I want to know what makes a person like you tick. In other words, tell us more about yourself. I mean, I believe I read you're from Miami, you're a former cop. Tell us what life experiences lead you to this career in juvenile justice reform.
Actually, I wasn't a cop. I was a senior police bureau commander.
What does that mean?
That means I held a position in the police department that can be held by either a sworn person or a non-sworn person. And I headed the Juvenile Assessment Center as a non-sworn person when the JAC actually fell under the jurisdiction of the county police department.
Mm-hmm. So?
And the way I got there was because I was one of the people, the team of people, that got together in Miami to try to form a juvenile assessment center because, as you very eloquently stated, we had a real mess down there.
You sure did, but something got you interested initially in this area. What got you there?
The thing that got me most interested in juvenile justice was that growing up as a child, I was in trouble every day of my life.
You were not.
I was. I absolutely was in trouble every day, and I had no clue how, still don't, how I always got into trouble. And I began to realize that the vast majority of kids in the juvenile justice system have something in common with that. They find themselves constantly getting in trouble, and many times they have no idea how they got there.
Now, what could you have done to get you in trouble?
I'm still pondering that, and I haven't come up with it. But, you know, one of the things, and I think the people who are here today who work with juvenile justice on a day-to-day basis, particularly the place in juvenile justice where we sit, which means everybody comes together, you can see that there's like three very broad categories of kids coming into juvenile justice. You have kids who do something stupid that day, and they get caught, and they get into trouble, and that might be the only thing that ever gets them into the system. Then you have the vast majority of kids who are kids who have some sort of issue. And those issues range from the temporary family problem or the temporary girlfriend, boyfriend, angst problem to problems that are very serious and chronic, learning disabilities, abuse, neglect, substance abuse problems, domestic violence. And usually those children, and I believe they're children, are acting out just like little ones act out. The problem is they don't look like little children, so people sort of think they're mini adults and try to treat them in that manner. And then the last group is the group that are committing the serious crimes. They are the ones displaying the most criminal behavior. They are the ones that people who don't work in juvenile justice think of when they hear the term juvenile justice. And these are kids who usually start bouncing around before the age of 12. They have a unique set of issues that are sometimes different than the others. And there are patterns that emerge and trends that emerge. And when you start having the ability to pay attention to those differences and starting to work with the child and his family before the crime he commits becomes more important than his own personal issues, you start to see a major difference.
Hmm. These are complex issues.
Yes, they are.
These are different kids that you're describing.
Yes.
Despite the fact that they may fit into some general categories.
Right.
So what went wrong in Miami? What were you doing wrong?
In the beginning, well, first of all, you have a juvenile justice system. And people, again, who are not in the juvenile justice system sort of see this as sort of this one unit that's sort of gyrating there. But when you actually understand what constitutes the juvenile justice system, you recognize that it is a group of very different agencies that have very unique statutory responsibilities, and they sort of fit in together to create this juvenile justice system. You have law enforcement, you have the courts, you have the juvenile justice people, you have the social service people. You can't involve a child or a juvenile without having the education system at least in some fashion engaged. Many times you have the child welfare people, because sometimes the more serious children are children who have crossed over from other systems. So when you put this group together, you have to start moving it in the same direction, even though what brings them to that system may not be moving in that direction from the very beginning.
Well, that's easy to say, huh? I mean, all these different facets you've got to bring together, these different groups from the community to law enforcement, social service agencies, That's a monumental amount of change. So you have to start somewhere.
Right.
So I'm going to name a few key phrases, and you go from there.
Okay.
Now, we've heard this phrase a lot, and in past elections, it's been used to make fun of people. But I think it really is something that you really take to heart when it comes to dealing with this issue of juvenile justice. It takes a village.
Yes, it does. And what we worked very, very hard to do was get a group of people who, in the very beginning when we started this effort, didn't work terribly well together, didn't think very highly of each other, and absolutely didn't like each other, how we could start developing some sort of common ground that would allow us to move forward. Now, clearly, the best change agent in this system was going to be our JAC, because when we put our juvenile assessment center by statute in the state of Florida, that constitutes an arrest facility. So by being at that entry point with all of the police departments bringing the juveniles to the JAC, where the booking would take place and the processing and the organization would take place, it allowed us to really act as that focal point change agent. So as we began to operate, clearly we could not operate without the partnership and the involvement of all of the other juvenile justice partners. And from the very beginning, we established that we all wanted to bring fewer children into the system. We wanted less arrests. We wanted less crime, and that was really the launching pad from where we took it to where we are now.
You said something in answering that question that struck me, which was change agent. Someone had to step forward and get the ball rolling, and that was you, wasn't it?
Yes.
So at what point did your head come off of your shoulders and you say, it's time to do something?
Well, when we pulled together the opening of the Juvenile Assessment Center, which in the very beginning co-located everyone, but over the years has evolved to us pretty much doing everyone's jobs for them. But in the very beginning, when we first opened, and we had, as was mentioned previously, an incredibly dysfunctional system. So we worked for 2.5 years, really, to pull this facility together and to sort of revisit all of the processes so that we could start to function. And amazingly enough, when a child would be arrested in Miami-Dade County before the JAC, it could take up to 6 weeks to move them through the process.
And you mean Juvenile Assessment Center?
Right.
When you say JAC, just
yes,
for our listeners.
Yes, yes, yes. The facility that processes arrest. It would take, unless they were actually detained, and that was difficult to do because detention of a juvenile is contingent not only on what he commits at that moment, but his past record. And when you didn't actually have reliable records at that point or access to those records, it was very difficult to know who should be detained and who should not be detained. And if a child was not detained, sometimes the paperwork could take 6 weeks to get to a point where the state attorney was making filing decisions and the court got involved. And of course, that's a lifetime to an adolescent. So when you get in trouble and nothing happens a week later or 2 weeks later or 4 weeks later, some credibility issues start to emerge. So when we began to operate our JAC and we joined together our juvenile assessment facility, we literally took 6 weeks worth of work and reduced it into a couple of hours. We implemented the first live scan fingerprint system, which in the United States for juveniles, actually. And what that allowed us to do is to know whether this child was being arrested for the first time or for the fifth time, which means everything based on what you're doing in juvenile justice. And so with that level of efficiency achieved, we began to see the next level and then the next level and start to work through it.
Let's go back now for a second. Forgive me, we got ahead of ourselves here, because I want to really set the stark contrast between what was going on in Florida before this model came to be. And it starts with a name. Martin Lee Anderson.
Ah, yes.
Can you talk about that and the boot camps versus the academies for a second?
Well, that is a very painful thing for people in the juvenile justice system to discuss in the state of Florida. And that was just for people who don't know about Martin Lee Anderson, he was in a boot camp that was being operated by a sheriff's department. And he was engaging in physical activity, and something began to go very, very wrong. And what ultimately happened was being restrained forcefully by the deputy sheriffs, he ended up dying. And it was a tragic event. It was particularly painful for us in Miami because we had, this young man had been arrested and put into this boot camp because he was joyriding in his grandmother's car while she was sitting in church. And in Miami, we don't detain children for that. But in this particular part of Florida, he was put into this boot camp. And even under the direct vision of a nurse, he was not able to breathe, and he ultimately died. And it is extremely painful. And I know there's been some similar type tragic events that have happened in New York State.
Mm. But, of course, that led to the Martin Lee Anderson Act. Maybe
yes.
You could talk about what that is, and then talk about the Star Sheriff Training and Respect Program.
Boot camps have always been fairly controversial, particularly when you are putting 13, 14, 15-year-olds in them. They might serve a purpose preparing young men of adult age to go into the military, but when you're talking about 13, 14-year-olds, it's an approach that many people believe, myself included, to not be a particularly productive approach. But it was an avenue that was being used by several sheriff's departments in the state of Florida. We did not have it available in Miami-Dade. One of the things that did come out of this terrible, tragic event was the elimination of the boot camp concept. So that now any law enforcement agency having a program that works with juveniles must base it upon the needs of the child, assessment and service driven, and respect, where the children are treated with respect and they are taught to respect in return.
So no physical or mental intimidation here?
No, not at all.
Another aspect of this, of course, was you had to get people to buy into it. And you went the route of police chiefs, right?
Yes.
Talk about that. How do you get different groups to buy into these solutions and go with it? You could easily stereotype and say, lots of police officers say, hang them high.
Yes.
That's a no good Nick. That's a no good kid.
We have 37 police departments in Miami-Dade County. And also, instead of an elected sheriff in Miami-Dade, we have an appointed police director who operates a countywide police department with 9 district stations. So you could almost say we have almost 40 different individual departments.
Sound familiar, New Yorkers?
And one of the things that, from the very beginning, because I happened to be working at the police department, I was, for the police director, I was one of the people who were able to be a part of the original group putting the Juvenile Assessment Center together. Now, at that time, we determined that the average amount of time that an officer spent off the road processing a juvenile was about 6 hours of downtime. Because of the protections in place for juveniles, these 37 or 40 different locations, if the detention center would not accept the juvenile or if they were not arrested for something, it was up to that police officer to find a responsible adult and not commingle that juvenile with any adults. So many times you have police officers off the road for many hours, more than 6 hours, with a child handcuffed to a chair, trying to find a relative, trying to find a responsible adult to take custody of the juvenile. And there is a legendary young man in Miami-Dade County who kept an officer on overtime for 18 hours, insisting that his name was Donald Duck. And they could not do anything but just sit there with him. And, of course, no other officers wanted to take custody of him, so the arresting officer was ruining ever laying eyes on this kid. But he sat there for 18 hours until he became bored enough to actually tell them who he was, because he was ready to go home at that time.
On that note, we remind you that you are listening to an interview with Wansley Walters, director of the Miami-Dade County Juvenile Services Department. I'm David Gustina from WAMC, and we're taking part in the fourth program in our five-part symposium series on juvenile justice reform, sponsored by the New York State Division of Criminal Justice Services in partnership with the State Office of Children and Family Services, the Division of Probation and Correctional Alternatives, Senator Velma Montgomery, and Assemblyman William Scarborough. The series is supported with a generous grant from the Public Welfare Foundation in Washington, D.C. Well, no doubt, Ms. Walters, if having been in New York now for a little bit, and I know you're going down to New York City after this, you're aware that New York has a little deficit problem. We don't have any money. And I noticed in an article I was reading that one of the things you tell people is to forget about the money.
Yes.
When you're planning a project like this, forget about it. Don't worry about the money. Plan the project. It'll come. Talk about that field of dreams, will you?
I believe that very, very much, and it sounds like very much like a Pollyanna, but I'm too old to be Pollyanna at this point, and we've been doing this too long to not realize that there's some actual value to taking that. Results. When we began planning our juvenile assessment center, again, pulling together the very people who didn't care much for each other, the only way we could get everybody into the room and to start actually thinking about how we could rethink everything we do was to tell them to forget about the money. Just forget the money. We'll come up with the money. Just let's figure out, just if we had the money, how we would do this. And so everyone began to very earnestly engage in the planning of how we would pull together this juvenile assessment center. And somehow, by the time we were narrowing it down to open, we got money from the legislature, we got money from the county, a building materialized downtown, and we were able to get our jack open. Once we opened and we began to achieve the efficiencies, we began to see the patterns, we began to see that we were doing everything. We had these different categories of children. They were all had very individual situations. And we had this cookie cutter way of processing, and it didn't make any sense, and it was illogical. We could have a juvenile arrested on Monday, and we go through these motions, and he gets arrested on Wednesday, and we go through the same motions. And, I mean, it just was not logical. So we decided we wanted to change how we do it, and we weren't really sure how we were going to do that. So we started engaging in a community-wide plan to, if we could reform the system, how we would start to reform the system and what would be the things we needed. And we decided to go to Washington. And at the time, my husband was doing work in Washington. And we decided we would ask our congressional delegation to help us get some money. And because there was no grant to do what we wanted to do. And we thought we'd ask for $1 million because that seemed like a whole lot of money at the time. Mm. And he said, well, if you want $1 million, you should ask him for $3 million. So we went up and we asked for $3 million, and we said, we're going to change the system and we're going to do things differently. And within 6 months, we had $3 million.
That's amazing. You know, you mentioned you're not Pollyanna about this, and I know you're not, because one of the things that's great about when you describe how you went about this, you don't cover over the rough edges. You really say, in order for us to make change, we're going to fight.
Yes.
We're going to scream at each other, and we're not going to like each other. But on the other side, something will happen. Talk about that.
Something will happen. When we initially began the changes that have led us to make so much progress in our community, it was almost human nature that if we said we want to do one thing, somebody else was going to argue about it. Even if we were convinced that it would improve the system, improve life, bring world peace, and eliminate world hunger, it didn't matter. It was just human nature from every perspective to fight it. But over the years, we have worked through those issues mainly by having everybody at the table. You know, it's easy to build up a head of steam and fight people when you don't understand what they do. And when you sit around a table long enough and you hear that it doesn't work well to do things in this manner, and we are required to do these things in this manner because you as the state attorney or you as the judge or whatever have dictated that we do it this way, but it actually makes no sense. So suddenly you start revisiting how you do things. And you start trying to do things. At lunch, I was having a conversation with someone about planning processes. Every time we wanted to implement change, we would bring everybody together and we would plan and plan and plan. And it's easy to just plan forever. But you really should just start trying it out. Just you have to start doing it, because no matter how well you plan, what you will find is there are always things that you didn't plan for. So you always have to fine-tune it. You always have to rethink it. It never goes off the way you think it will. But if you are all in it together, then you will start to pull it together. And when you start looking at these children as individual children with individual issues and families, something starts to change. Now, I can tell you that 10 years later, actually less than 10 years, I'd say 5 years later, what we have in Miami, and Miami is not a warm, cuddly, it might be hot, but it's not a warm, cuddly community, is a system within our juvenile justice system and our child welfare system, where it is very easy for people to say, we need to do something different with this group of children. And no one blinks. People sit there, and if it doesn't involve their actual agency, they'll still be a part of the planning, providing the input, knowing that the actual decisions have to be made by the affected agencies. And it has become nothing to change what we do. And it is truly a night and day situation. It is that dramatic.
You may need to talk to our governor and legislative leaders, because they're having a hard time making it, you know, to December to make decisions on what to do with our money. We may be in arrears. I want to move to something else here, which I think is also important, something that you talked about as you went forward and all these different groups are involved. And it's simplified by one phrase, which keep them in their own lane.
Yes. Yes. It's important to be in the room listening to how people do their jobs, because it does bring the hostility level down. It's kind of hard to get angry at a police officer when you start to understand exactly what he's trying to do and what his job responsibilities are due. Same with the clerk of the court, same with the social worker, same with the probation officer. And one of the things that was extremely amazing was that people really, even though they thought they knew what everybody did, they didn't. But when you're in a room And the police officer has to change what he does, and the social worker has to change what he does in order for a process to be facilitated. They have to be the ultimate decision maker. You can't have someone who isn't in that particular line making those decisions, but it is incredibly helpful to have everyone there because they begin to have an understanding of what each other does and a little compassion for their role in this thing we call a system.
Another phrase that was used I thought was very powerful, and I think it probably could be applied to New York and to every other state in this country, if not the world, and something that other states, unlike, or other city counties like Miami-Dade, don't do, which is move the rules to fit the child, not the child to fit the rules. Can you talk about that?
Well, when we started to actually make progress and we actually began to understand everyone's rules and roles, we began to also recognize that the things that we had to most be sensitive to were the state statutes and the laws that governed us. But even at that point, we began to understand we could change those. But many times, we would be making these sort of arbitrary decisions and dictates on this. When a child would come into the system, he would automatically have to do this because this is what is the rule. And he would have to go to this one because that was the rule. And we started to realize that in a whole lot of cases, those rules didn't make any sense. And the rules, in fact, were going to ultimately do more damage to getting that child moved out of the system than helping them. And so we began to sort of change the rules to fit the child. And let me give you a couple of examples. In one case, we learned that there were 2 9-year-olds who were found with heroin. And that is a pretty shocking thing to hear, that you have 2 9-year-olds with heroin in an elementary school. But by this time, we had made a lot of progress. And so the police officer got on the phone with me, and we got on the phone with the state attorney. And we decided that before we put handcuffs on the 2 9-year-olds, which used to happen fairly regularly in Miami, what we would do is we would go to the school and try to learn what was happening with these two children. And so we got with our child welfare people and we got with some of our caseworkers because we have a whole set of protocols we work with children under the age of 12. We went to the school and learned that these two little 9-year-old boys found something as they were walking to school. They weren't selling it. They weren't using it. They didn't know what the word heroin actually was, but they were showing it to their friends, which is what you usually do when you're 9 years old. And so what we did was we talked to the children. We went to the children's homes. We talked to their families. Actually, one family was absolutely fine. One family actually needed some services that weren't even really related to that child. And we were able to access them. And we explained how dangerous it is to pick up things like this and what the repercussions could be, and these little wide-eyed boys were sort of mortified that what they had was so serious that they could have been in the back of a police car and with a felony arrest that could have changed their lives forever. And this is something that I think is very critical. It costs a lot of money. You can approach this from a variety of different directions. It costs a lot of money to make an arrest. Actually, we determined in the state of Florida many, many years ago, and we even stopped tallying it up, it costs about $5,000 every time you book someone into the system because you have to engage so many systems, so many cross-checks. And after that point, that agency has to have a tie to that name and that number so that their statutory role gets fulfilled. And that takes people, and it takes a lot of money to pull that off. And what also happens is that a lot of juveniles, in particular, get arrested. They get arrested for things that adults don't get arrested for. They just get citations and have to go to court. So what do? We take a child, we put handcuffs on them, and we put them in the back of a car. And I don't care if he's 8 years old or he's 16 years old. His life will completely change. Let me give you another example.
Please.
You've got children who will go to a mall on a Saturday afternoon, 5-6 kids. And one of them will shoplift, or even potentially somebody might think they're about to shoplift. And you'll have a store manager get crazy. You will have other customers get frightened that there's a group of kids. Anyway, the store manager insists that some shoplifting took place, and all the juveniles get arrested. So then they're either taken to the station, or they're taken to a juvenile assessment center or a booking facility. And what you have are five kids getting arrested and five kids who'll end up going to court. Now, let's just say that you've got one juvenile who's a good student. He's in an after-school prevention program that's having a very positive effect on him. He comes from a single-parent household, and his mother's working hard to keep that family together, and she doesn't work in a job that she can just like announce that she's got to show up in court, because she's in a situation where she doesn't have that. So what you have is you have this juvenile, and he has this court date, and he now has been arrested in front of his friends and his neighbors, and everybody looks at him differently. His school starts to look at him differently. The prevention program that he was doing so well in doesn't want him anymore because he's now been arrested and he's crossed some kind of line that they don't find acceptable. His court date comes. His mother either forgot about it, maybe she didn't understand the whole process, maybe she was told she would lose her job if she left. Whatever it is, an adult did not go to that school and physically check the child out of school and take him to court. So what do in the state of Florida? We rearrest him. And now we automatically put him into the detention center, where we have spent more money, and we are now paying extra money for his pre-adjudicatory costs in the detention center. And his life really has changed. His mother is angry and hurt that he got rearrested without realizing that she's the reason why he got rearrested. His neighbors, his school that he was doing so well in, they start to really back away with their expectations. And in this get tough society, we have taken a kid who really never did anything to begin with, and we have sort of systemized him right into jail, where if he's a minority child, he might have heard all along you're going to end up locked up and you really never have to do anything to have that happen. And those are the kinds of things that are happening in our system today. And many times it takes an awfully strong support system around that child to help him overcome that, because it's very hurtful.
I'll let you all think about that while I remind you that you're listening to an interview with Wansley Walters, director of the Miami-Dade County Juvenile Services Department, who's taking part in the fourth program in our five-part symposium series on juvenile justice reform, which is sponsored by the New York State Division of Criminal Justice Services in partnership with the State Office of Children and Family Services, the Division of Probation and Correctional Alternatives, Senator Velmanette Montgomery, and Assemblyman William Scarborough. The series is supported with a generous grant from the Public Welfare Foundation in Washington, D.C. I'm David Gustina, and Wansley, my goodness, it really sounds like you're saying that the juvenile justice system in general in the United States keeps kids down, doesn't allow them to escape, in some cases, their circumstances. And why don't you just move this over into what you actually did, the civil citation program?
Yes. We saw a lot of juveniles that were having the type of thing I just discussed happen, or maybe even they got into a diversion program, because we do offer a continuum of diversion programs from minor offenses to more serious offenses. But they were finding that they were not able to get school loans, many times when they were in academically competitive situations and all things being equal. Those forms don't ask you if you were ever convicted of a crime. They ask you, have you ever been arrested? And explain yourself. And if all things are equal and it's down between you and some other person and they've never been arrested and you have with those records, that can hold you back. And children were not able to get the normal after school jobs because of this. And so initially we developed a program where with our state statute, we went to Tallahassee, we changed the statute that if you completed a post-arrest diversion or any kind of diversionary program, that you could have your record expunged and not use the one-time lifetime expungement that every Florida citizen has a right to. And we thought we had really worked something out, and we worked with the families and we were getting those records expunged, only to find out that the Florida Department of Law Enforcement were selling databases to these major companies that the department stores and other businesses and credit bureaus and all sorts of things were using to access to find out if people had records. So the possibility of you have some sort of minor thing, you go successfully complete whatever we put you through, your parents pay their $75 and get everybody to sign the paperwork, and that piece of paper comes back that says your record has been expunged. But when you go to apply at McDonald's, McDonald's Corporation uses some other corporation that has bought a database and finds out that not only have you been arrested, but you have lied. So we realized that we needed to have something in place that would allow kids to get in trouble and do something stupid without actually having to pay for it with their futures. And so we used something that was in the state statute called civil citation. I don't know if that's something that you have in place in the state of New York. But it was something in our state statute that allowed a police officer to make that decision not to arrest a juvenile, but in fact take him home, talk to the parents, maybe assist them in getting services. And this was a perfectly acceptable legal avenue for a police officer to take. But in Miami-Dade County, those programs, as a rule, operated when a department had a grant or when the department was in a very affluent area and the police officers didn't have a lot of crime that they had to contend with. They were not only public safety, but also somewhat of a chamber of commerce function for the community. So those were the program, those were the areas where you would find a civil citation, and usually they would peter out after a while. It would be dependent upon that one officer and that one child. Never happened in the less affluent areas, never happened in the high crime areas. So you had a situation where certain children were given that opportunity, but other children were not. So we went to all 37 police directors, police chiefs, and we said, will you let us manage this population? And we will hold this arrest form, and we will address the speedy trial and all the legal processes. But if we work with this child and this family, and we get them through this process, can we keep them from going into the system? And furthermore, they not only agreed to that, and our state attorney agreed to that, but we'll let them get in trouble twice. They can get in trouble again. As long as they successfully complete it the first time, if they get in trouble later, we'll do it all over again. And what we do is exactly what we do when they're under arrest for a minor offense. We do an assessment. We determine if they were shoplifting because they were just tagging along with their friends, or were they shoplifting because they're using drugs and they needed to sell what they were stealing, or were they doing it because they were being sexually abused by mom's boyfriend and they were acting out in some capacity. And we start to get them exactly the service that they need, which allows us to be very strategic with our resources. And what we have found since we implemented this in April 2007 is that we've had over 5,500 kids who would have been arrested receive a civil citation. And of these juveniles with civil citation plans, 83% of those juveniles successfully completed, with the involvement of their family, exactly what they had to do. And of the 83%, only 3% have gotten in trouble since then, and 95% are minority. So this is a critically important program when we think about how easy it is for children to be sucked into the deeper end of the system, how if we can just work with them outside of the system can be outside the system, you know. It doesn't, you don't have to have this legal arm pounding them over the head to be working with them and helping them.
It seems like, in a way, you're able to create an atmosphere of discretion.
Yes.
And probably the most important group to have in hand is police. You need, I think, right? You would say the police have to believe in what you're doing, and it probably won't happen.
It's important to have police. Absolutely, you must have police. And I believe that the leadership in law enforcement agencies recognize that you can't arrest yourself out of a crime problem. Too many officers arrest people over and over and over again. You know, they're sort of the gatekeepers. So, you know, it's very frustrating to them to be rearresting the same people, and then from one reason or another, they're back on the street or they come out of prison or whatever, whatever. And so most leadership in a law enforcement agency has sort of been there and done that, and they realize that what something that we've been doing in this country hasn't actually worked. The challenge we found with civil citation had been the individual officers. And that was why it was so critical to have the leadership, because when the officer, and we have a great state attorney, we actually have great judges, we have, you know, and I didn't always say that. We've come full circle, and they didn't care much for me either. I will have to give that
to them. I don't believe it.
Anyway, the one thing that we found was you would have officers coming in, because our statute does say that the officer has the final say. But what we would took, because we...
That was smart.
Because we have police lieutenants there who really oversee that initial entrance into the arrest process, we would let them know that since their police chief signed off on it, if they said they did not want a juvenile in the civil citation program, then we would go back to their police chief, and we would. And many times what it got down to is what I think happens with police officers and kids from the very beginning, is you've got kids who make officers mad. They are not respectful. An officer will ask them to stop, give me your name, and this 13-year-old in all of his judgment hauls off. And so it makes the officer mad. Or you will have, you know, and this is particularly prevalent with girls. If you don't treat a girl with respect, ladies, is this not true? We get a little feisty, and we will be disrespectful in return. And so a lot of times, the girls will smart off at the officers, and they get arrested. So by the time they get to our facility, they've all built up a head of steam, and the officer is very, very angry. And this is something that we need to take into consideration when we put the child into a series of services, and that is, it is just not a smart thing to be smarting off at a police officer. But it also isn't, smarting off at a police officer shouldn't ruin the rest of your life. And if you are coming into that system and you don't have a support structure that can make sure you are crossing your T's and dotting your I's all the and moving you out of here, you could get sucked into the deep end just because you had a big mouth. And as someone who had a big mouth, I can tell you that I could easily have been one of these children.
And the fact of the matter is, and this is no insult to police officers, but they're not psychologists and they're not social workers. And there's a statistic that I saw when I was researching that two-thirds of boys in Florida, the state, the whole state, have some type of psychological disorder. So people coming in have problems.
Yes.
And it's not personal to the police.
No, it's not personal to the police. Let me tell you a story that just made this great impression on me. One day I was actually walking through the secure part of our facility where the arrested juveniles are being booked. And there was this very sweet-looking young man who was sort of dejected, and I asked him why he was there. And he told me that he had hit a police officer. And I was kind of taken back, and I said, well, you know, what would make you think that was a good idea? And he explained that his mother had a new boyfriend. And when he went home, he was 16 years old, actually taking courses at the community college in pre-college. Great student. He came home, and his mother's new boyfriend told his mother to tell him that he couldn't live there anymore because the boyfriend didn't want him there. And he was hurt, and he was angry, and I remember thinking, I'm a grown woman, and I think if my mother told me that she didn't want me to come home, it would really hurt my feelings, and I don't even live with her anymore.
It's hurting my feelings, and I'm not even involved.
Well, what he did was he was so angry that he got in his car and he peeled off and he did some sort of traffic infraction in front of an officer who pulled him over, and it was just the final straw. He got out of the car and he hit the cop. So, you know, sometimes when you start to delve into these situations, they just melt your heart. And that is why when we were all there as this collective unit and started to realize how some of the things that we were doing to protect our agencies, to protect our statutory responsibility, to show that we were tough and whatever, was just doing so much more damage. And I can tell you that I am the greatest supporter of our law enforcement in Miami-Dade County. But what we have with, actually it's now down to 46% fewer arrests than we had in the late 90s. We don't have that because officers are not making arrests for crimes being committed. We have less crime. And that is even before the civil citation. We have less crime.
Now, of course, we're in New York State, where we're working on the old model here. So we could argue that the results that we're getting we're probably not happy with. And I can hear many of the more conservative friends of ours in the state saying, come on, Pollyanna, you can't do it this way. This is too easy on the kids. They don't learn anything this way, individual by individual. They did something wrong. They should be punished. So is the way to go about this with folks who maybe hold these attitudes to point out the recidivism rate drops, crime drops, and then money?
Money. Money is big. What we've been able to do with our Juvenile Assessment Center, which, if you recall, was co-locating all of the different agencies, we now have become so efficient at what we do that we do their jobs for them. And by paying attention to the juveniles and working with them and using any community service that was available, not just a juvenile justice service, but any community service, whether it's substance abuse or anger management or mental health services, what we've been able to do is reduce the population so all of our related agencies, the state attorney's office, the public defender, the courts, the clerk's office, the judges, the court dockets, that is all half of what it used to be. So we have saved a huge amount of money. And the White House and the Justice Department held a juvenile justice summit in Miami last May to focus on our model that we have collectively put together. And a separate independent group did an economic analysis, a very conservative economic analysis, that showed that the way we do business in Miami-Dade County saves over $30 million a year. And when you back out the cost of our department, you are still saving $21 million every single year.
It's truly amazing. We're starting to run out of time, but I really want you to share a success story with us. And the name Teresa Sinclair jumps out.
Teresa was a young lady who is, she's a very lovely, beautiful young lady. And when she was about 14 years old, there was a young man who had a crush on her. So he was kind of insistent on trying to get her to be his girlfriend. And there was nothing terrible about it. I mean, he would like try to walk her to class and so on and so forth. And this had just gone on a long, long time. So one day he was sort of interjecting himself into a line and some shoving took place. He sort of bumped into her being playful and she had just had enough and she shoved him. So she ended up getting arrested for this. Now, she happened to be from one of the families that didn't quite get her into court on time. So she found herself in the detention center. And it was very traumatic and very hurtful and very painful to her. But she survived it. She went to high school. She got out of school. She enrolled in college. And she applied at the Juvenile Services Department in Miami-Dade County, where we had to fight with the state of Florida to hire her because she had been arrested. And we had to get clearance from the Department of Juvenile Justice. And I love the people in the Department of Juvenile Justice, so I'm not trying. But at that time, that's what we had to do.
She was on the list.
She was on the list. And we were able to hire her, and she turned into a model employee. She is a very eloquent public speaker who told her story at our White House summit and also for the media. And she's now a mother, and she's just this wonderful, wonderful young lady that we never would have come to know had we not wanted to give a chance to someone who had been arrested as a juvenile.
What a wonderful story. Now, I know you've been traveling a lot.
Yes.
And not only pushing this benchmark, this model of yours around the U.S., but overseas as well. And you mentioned to me before we came on here that you had recently been in Thailand. Talk about some of the international places that you've been and what their systems are like and what you're doing with them.
Well, when I first started working in juvenile justice, I never imagined that I would travel so much, but particularly travel around the world, which is actually a responsibility when you do a national demonstration project, because your responsibility with the federal dollars is to help people replicate it. But amazingly enough, the European Union has been incredibly interested, and we've been there several times. In particular, Ireland had us be the focus of their research project, and they're really focusing on the collaboration. But our real thrill is the fact that the Kingdom of Thailand had been to visit us and other places and decided that they wanted to model their entire country after what we've done in Miami-Dade County. And so we went and worked with about 50 people, judges and the same people in juvenile justice that work in the United States work in Thailand. And they spent some time with us this summer. And when we returned from New York, the head of juvenile justice from Thailand and many of the judges will be in Miami going through a whole week program and visiting our services delivery, our courts, the detention center, and all of the other pieces of our system.
My goodness, we've quickly running out of time here. Wesley Walters, take just a moment now to address our audience here, not only on the radio, but the specific audience in the room who are looking to implement solutions and solve problems rather than be mired down in the same old system that seems not to work. Okay. What would you say to them now?
I would say that if you care about these kids, then you need to be relentless and you need to never give up on changing this system, because so much of what we're all doing just doesn't make a lot of sense. And if you have reached a point where you believe that you cannot change the system, that it might work in Miami, but it won't work in my community because I'm in a rural community, and it won't work in my community because my community's twice the size of Miami, or I live in a middle-sized city, or we have a police chief that won't do this, and we have that, then you need to care enough about these children to get in another field of work. Because if we don't change the way these systems are acting as a feeder pattern into our prisons, if we don't care enough to understand that every child that gets arrested has feelings, and many times they don't have the support structure around them that we give our own children, if you think it can't be done, then you need to let someone else who does believe this take your place.
Well, I'm so sorry. We are out of time for our program today. What an incredible time we've had with Wansley Walters. And, of course, you've been listening to the fourth symposium in a five-part series, Enhancing Community Safety Through Cost-Effective Juvenile Justice Reform. The series is supported with a generous grant from the Public Welfare Foundation, is being co-sponsored by the Division of Criminal Justice Services, the Office of Children and Family Services, the Division of Probation and Correctional Alternatives, Assemblyman William Scarborough, and Senator Velmanette Montgomery. A huge thanks again to Wansley Walters, and a special thanks to Lorraine Hogan for her assistance with the program today. And finally, a reminder, if you want to hear this or any of our other interviews in our series, just head to our website at wamc.org. Until next time, thanks for listening.
What a wonderfully rich exchange, and very informational and helpful, and I think something that causes us all to reflect on the challenges that you've laid out, Wansley. So I want to thank Wansley Walters and David Gustina for that exchange, and we'll be coming back, but we'll be taking a short break till 2:20, so if you could try to be back on time, we'll continue this rich dialogue. Thank you.